Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Diana Isaacs, and Natalie Bellini, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve care. Produced by endocrinologynetwork.com, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on endocrinologynetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm with my wonderful colleague, Natalie Bellini. And we have a very action-packed episode today. We've been talking about tirzepatide, but now it is actually FDA approved, and it's called Mounjaro, which is really cool because it reminds me of the mountain Kilimanjaro, which is like the highest mountain in the world. So that's very exciting. And also today, we are going to talk about some of the ACE updates because that conference just concluded this past weekend, as well as an exciting announcement for MannKind and a quick forecast of what to expect at ADA. So with that, Natalie, I want to turn it over to you to see what you can tell us about this new FDA approval of tirzepatide and what it means for practice.
So we are really excited about tirzepatide's approval in our practice. When we look at the SURPASS studies, SURPASS 1 demonstrated an A1C change of 1.87 to 2.07. SURPASS 2, again, A1C change 2.9 to 2.46%. We are looking at significant improvement in A1C, but we're also looking at some significant weight loss in some of the other SURPASS trials. And so I think the combination of the two is what we're really excited about. Dr. Isaacs, maybe we can talk a little bit about what a GIP and GLP-1 dual agonist is versus what we've been used to using in practice, which is the GLP-1 receptors.
Yeah, so we know when food is eaten, incretins are released, and that includes GLP and GIP. And up until this point, we've really only had the GLP-1 so far. And so what that does, what these incretins do is they actually slow gastric emptying, which promotes satiety. And also they cause the pancreas to actually release more insulin. So some people think, well, wouldn't that cause hypoglycemia? But they actually do this in a glucose-dependent way. And then they also cause suppression of glucagon, which we know can increase glucose levels. So through all of this, they're able to promote weight loss and also a lot of A1C lowering. And so the thought is with this incretin, with this dual agonist now, you basically have potentially twice the amount of power. And in people with type 2 diabetes, we know that their endogenous production of these incretins is low. They just don't produce as much as a person without diabetes. So through the use of this agent, we get these supra therapeutic levels. And now with this dual incretin, we're getting even more. And that is hypothesized why we see with tirzepatide, there's actually more A1C lowering. There is more weight loss. And I have to tell you, I mean, this is so exciting. We have not had a new class of medication for diabetes in years. We had the GLP-1 agonist back in 2005 and then the SGLT2 inhibitors in 2012. So it's been 10 years. So this truly is really, really exciting.
And I think you really did. You know, when we can get the pancreas to respond to glucose all by itself, we get a much better response, right? So we can't match this with anything else. And so I'm super excited. You know, the A1C reduction is a lot about the postprandial reduction on top of with that GIP added, right? And then, you know, when I talk to patients about it, I say, this is a designer hormone. It only works when you need it to in that glucose dependent way. And so we have less concern about hypoglycemia. We have less concern while we still get a very good reduction in A1C at the same time.
Now I do have some concern about the adverse effects. So we know not every person tolerates a GLP-1 agonist. So this drug also has similar potential side effects like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain. And in theory, because this is a little stronger, those things can happen, which is why there is a specific dosing titration. With all the GLP-1 agonists, we have a certain dosing where we start at a lower dose. And this is just like that. We actually have a 2.5 milligram dose. And then after 4 weeks, you can keep increasing by 2.5 milligrams. And so there's actually 6 different dosing pens. So you're going to start at the 2.5. Each one has the one-time dose. And then you would get a prescription for 1 month and then go to the next one. So Natalie, I'm curious. You see lots of patients. How do you think this dosing titration is going to work in practice? Do you see any barriers to all these different pen sizes?
So I think what we need to remember in the back of all of this is the patient, right? So if I start at a 5 milligram dose and say to the patient, this is the first efficacious dose, go take this. And I don't give their bodies a chance to respond and have a minimal side effect, the patient will never take it again. And I think we've learned that, you know, the hard way, right? So the ability to titrate is really about getting this patient to stay on the medication, to reduce their A1C, to reduce their you know, as a secondary side effect, to reduce their weight. So I if we think about it patient-centrically, I think it makes sense. And I think what we're going to do, and it's not available, I tried to do it today. I've heard June 14th approximately. But I think what we're going to do is send in 4 weeks and just set a reminder in the EHR so that we, you know, my nurse will contact the patient, make sure they're having, you know, they're able to tolerate that dose. We'll plan on leaving them on it if they're having any issues at all for an additional month, because we can titrate as we feel as prescribers, right? And then go up as they tolerate the dose. I think that's the safest thing for the patient and for adherence.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it'll just require some HCP education just to know about the different doses and when to increase. Because ideally, we do want to try to get to the highest tolerated dose because that is the most efficacious. So that 15 milligram dose. So I know a lot of people are probably wondering, where is this going to land in guidelines? What do you think? Where do you see this in terms of our diabetes algorithms?
I think it's going to be considered early. I think our biggest challenge is that the CVOT trial will not be done until 2024. So the real question is going to be, where does this fall with no CVOT data? Do we assume that they have it? Do we make that jump? Do we make that leap? Do we use a GLP-1 which has proven CVOT data? I think that's going to be the biggest, you know, the biggest hurdle. I'm also concerned because at the time, semaglutide was only available in the head-to-head comparison at 1 milligram. It is now available at 2 milligrams. So there is also the head-to-head trial. We desperately need a head-to-head trial for tirzepatide against semaglutide 2.0.
Yeah, that is a great point. So I think, right, in terms of, we know like our algorithm, when we think about the ADA standards of care, the left side of the algorithm, heart failure, kidney disease,
right,
cardiovascular disease. If a person has those, that's going to guide them towards GLP-1 agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors. So until we have the CVOT data, I don't see how this could be on that side of the algorithm. But when it comes to trying to reduce risk of hypoglycemia and a more efficacious agent, and certainly weight loss, I think we're going to see, I would anticipate changes with the next standards of care, which would anticipated usually come out every December. So it'll be really exciting to kind of see what happens with all that. So I want to switch gears a little bit. So the ACE conference, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, that recently wrapped up, and there were a lot of very interesting presentations at that conference. But one that I particularly found very, very interesting was from Viral Shaw at Barbara Davis. And it was about the use of Tandem Control IQ in people that do not bolus at all. And what he found, this was a very small study, it just included 10 patients, but that they actually had an increase in time in range of 3.6 hours per day. They went from 39% to 54%. And they actually had a decrease in A1C of 1.5% after starting the system. And what's particularly interesting, so their initial A1C was 9.7%, and on average, it improved to 8.2%. And why I think this is so interesting is because often we hear, oh, well, if your A1C is over 9% or over 10%, you can't get a pump. You have to have a low A1C to get a pump. But this is showing in these patients that they actually, they had all these benefits, even though their A1C was, you know, starting off at a mean of 9.7, meaning some did have A1Cs over 10. So curious, Natalie, what's your take on all this new kind of this trial?
I was smiling ear to ear because I think you and I both have these patients already in our practices as well. And they are doing better. And we both know that an A1C reduction of 1.5% is significant, right? Our goal is never 8.2% for a patient, but if I can get them from a 9.7 on average to an 8.2 on average, I feel like I need to do it. Right. And so, is it ideal? No, but it's so much better. I do see patients who come to my practice, and again, we're in endocrinology, who have been told they can't get a pump. And we do offer them to patients with not an A1C someone else might consider ideal. I look at an insulin pump as a way to get insulin into someone's body. So they can use inhaled insulin, they can use smart pens, they can use a smart pump, and if this is going to improve it with very little effort from the patient, this is an answer. I do think it'll be interesting to see now that Omnipod 5 is on has been released, if we can get the same results out of other AID systems.
Yeah. And I think for our listeners that are maybe less familiar, so Tandem Control IQ, it's an automated insulin delivery. So that background insulin is always adjusting. However, a person is still expected to bolus for their carbohydrates normally. There is a feature, though, every hour, if a person's glucose levels are still high, they get an automatic correction. And so likely that mechanism is kind of helping for the people that just don't bolus, that don't enter in any carbs, that mechanism is helping. Now, when we compare this to other pumps, like we have the Medtronic 770G, it does not have this feature. However, the 780G, which is available in a lot of other countries, it does have automatic corrections up to every 5 minutes. So you would expect, right, with a system like that, if someone didn't bolus, that it would hopefully have maybe similar types of improvements, although we would need a study to know that for sure. And then with Omnipod 5, that's still newer. It does not have the auto corrections, but it certainly has this aggressive automatic basal in the background. So I think overall it is really encouraging. Of course, we want people to bolus because they're going to be able to increase to 70 or 80% time in range if they bolus, but it's good to know that this still will really have significant improvements. And so I think we need to rethink the criteria. Of course, we want to keep people safe. We don't want them to go into DKA, but we can be introducing this technology likely earlier and not waiting for someone to kind of earn their pump or have like earn the magic A1C to get their pump.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that for a lot of providers, this will help ease the restrictions on who to prescribe, who to allow a chance to see if this we can make this work for them.
Definitely. Now, one of the other big things that happened at ACE was the introduction of these new NASH guidelines, which we've been anticipating for a while. So Natalie, can you kind of walk us through some of the highlights of the presentation and what we see with these new guidelines?
Absolutely. So when we treat diabetes, I think lots of people don't recognize that there is a growing prevalence of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And it's truly an epidemic. Globally, the overall prevalence is estimated at 25%, but the highest prevalence rates come from the Middle East and South America. It is believed between 25 and 30% of patients with obesity have NAFLD, and between 30 and 40% of people with diabetes. So even when we look at this, the disease awareness remains very low. Patients, less than 5% of patients even know that they have it. So some of the new recommendations that came out about how to treat this, what do we do, is the use of pioglitazone as well as GLP-1s. So with for patients with type 2 and biopsy proven NASH, my immediate thing is how many of our patients are actually getting the biopsies? So Diana, how many patients do you send for biopsies for NASH? How do you guys deal with that?
Yeah, I would say we don't do a great job of it. Honestly, we don't, we don't focus on it. And I think some of it has probably been because we haven't had clear guidance. Like, what do you do? We know tons of our patients with type 2 diabetes probably have it, but we haven't confirmed it. And I think these guidelines really are good because now it classifies people into different risk categories when you should be getting a biopsy and when you should be ordering different tests to determine diagnosis.
Exactly. So what are some of the guidelines that were recommended? Clinicians should recommend dietary modification in persons with NAFLD, right? And reducing saturated fats, starches, and added sugars. And I put that into anything in boxes and bags. Right? That's really the way I present that. An adoption of healthier eating, including Mediterranean diet, right? That has been proven to help reduce NASH overall, right? In persons with NAFLD, clinicians must recommend physical activity that improves body composition and participate in a structured program, not just, maybe you should take a walk a couple of days a week, but truly setting realistic, smart goals. You're 3 days this week, I'm going to walk 10 minutes away from my house and 10 minutes back, those kinds of things. And maybe even send a patient, one of the ideas I thought of when I was reading these guidelines is, do you send them to physical therapy to develop a personalized program that they can do at home after that? That's one of the things that immediately came to my mind. And we don't do that. We really don't. So how do we decide to treat it? We need to consider treating with pioglitazone and or GLP-1s when there's an elevated probability of having NASH, which really opens up a door for us, because before it was biopsy, biopsy. People don't go for the biopsies. They're risky. We don't send our patients. We don't send them nearly enough. I know that for a fact. So if we have an inkling, can we use a pioglitazone? Can we use a GLP-1? If there's elevated amniotransferase levels, with no invasive test whatsoever. And I love that idea because now it's opened the door for that treatment.
Yeah. And just to reiterate, so it's interesting. So pioglitazone has been shown, even though it can cause weight gain, it redistributes the fat in a way that's really beneficial for NASH. But also one of the key takeaways I took was just weight loss, the power of weight loss. And so that's where we come back to the GLP-1 agonist, and then this new approval, tirzepatide, and both of those classes of medications are being studied for NASH. And so hopefully we'll get some of that outcome data. But in the meantime, certainly to promote that weight loss, it makes a lot of sense to use those classes of medications. And in fact, this guideline really, really highlights that. So one other thing I wanted to talk about today was this recent announcement I just heard about Mankind purchasing Vigo. So Vigo is actually, it's basically a wearable insulin device. It gives insulin in 2-unit increments. And it also has a background insulin of you can pick 20, 30, or 40 units. And previously it was owned by Zealand. So this is kind of big news. So Mankind, for those that aren't familiar, they're the ones that that promote Afrezza, the inhaled insulin. So it's really, to me, it's really interesting. Now they're going to have in their portfolio this inhaled insulin and then also this wearable insulin. And so I'm really curious to see how this is going to take shape. I don't know, Natalie, any comments on that?
So I think that there is the disposable patch pump is a great option for some patients, right? We can use it and say, do 3 button presses at breakfast, 4 at lunch, 3 at dinner, right? We can order them. And Diana, when you said 20, 30, and 40, that's total basal a day over the whole 24 hours, right? So for those of you who haven't used a Vigo in the past, I'm excited about it. Mankind has a good sales force. That is educated. And I think that they will do a really good job of supporting something like this, which is a big part of education, goes a long way.
Well, it
so
does.
I'm excited.
Yeah. And we haven't had a sales rep, I know, in like our Cleveland area in a while. But it's interesting because we also have Secure Simplicity, which is a wearable insulin device, and it holds up to 200 units of insulin, also does those 2-unit clicks. And that device can be worn for 3 days. So in the past, Vivo didn't really have this competition of secure simplicity. So anyway, it'll be really interesting how things shape out. Overall, as a healthcare professional, I'm thrilled that patients have options to choose from. So it'd be interesting how this all kind of plays out. And the reality is also a lot of people don't realize that inhaled insulin is even an option. So there's still, that's an option for people that a lot of people just don't know about. So to kind of conclude this episode, I wanted to do a little plug. So we've got ADA scientific sessions coming up. So exciting because it's going to be in person. There is a virtual option, but it will be in person this year. So I know Natalie and I will both be in New Orleans and we plan to do an episode live from there. But I wanted to promote Natalie is going to be speaking, doing this amazing session on whether time and range is the gold standard in glucose management. And so as part of the session is going to be Dr. Roy Beck talking about time and range validation, Dr. Grazia Aleppo on A1C versus time and range. And then our very own Natalie Bellini is going to be talking about clinically implementing time and range. And then we're going to hear from Dr. Earl Hirsch on individualizing time and range. And he actually also gave a great talk at ATTD about if time and range should replace A1C, which he said no at this time, but it definitely can supplement, it should supplement it. So also I am personally really excited to hear about readouts from the Beta Bionics islet study that with it's the insulin only arm, the first readout, but that's a new insulin pump that will eventually be dual hormone. And then also the Surmount program, the tirzepatide for weight management. There's going to be some readouts there. So all this to say, lots of exciting things coming up. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us for this episode. And we wish you all the best and we'll see you next time.